Delphine, viens voir, ils sont arrivés. Ils s'installent sur la place.
Tu sais, les gosses seront jamais prêts. Faudra les faire répéter dimanche matin.
Moi, ouais, non. Tu crois?
Nous sommes deux sœurs jurées, nées sous le signe des Gémeaux. Mi fa sol la mi ré, ré mi fa sol 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 ré do. Toutes deux demoiselles ayant eu des amants très tôt. Mi fa sol la mi ré, ré mi fa sol 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 ré do. Nous fûmes toutes deux élevées par maman, qui pour nous se priva travailla vaillamment. Elle voulait de nous faire des érudites, et pour cela vendit toute sa vie des frites. Nous vous sommes toutes données le père inconnu.
Mon nom est M9. You're Lippy the Lion, and I'm Hardy Har Har. Welcome to our program. It is a podcast about movies. Here's two things that I want to say.
I thought we established that you were Paw from the Hillbilly Bears.
No, that's you. That's you in my daily life. In my everyday life, that's you following me around going, Paw, sure is Marvin's account. Like, anytime I'm being grumbly or whatever. That's you doing that to me. That we have not established anything.
But I'm right.
As official about that. Two things I would like to say.
Yes.
Number one, you've played that song before as an intro.
Well, it was fitting this week, though.
It is fitting this week, but you've played that song before as an intro.
I'll remember that.
You cannot do no more Young Girls of Rochefort.
Okay.
As theme music. It's fine. Yeah, I love that movie. I love this. Everything about this, it's Catherine Deneuve and who else? No, it's were they singing?
They
for
were
themselves?
Actually dubbed. I think
they were dubbed. Okay,
but it's
Catherine Deneuve and
Françoise Dorléac,
her late sister,
mm-hmm.
In the movie Young Girls of Rochefort. Rochefort. Okay. The other thing
and
is
sorry to pick a French song twice in a row, but that song does fit with something we're talking about this week. So.
I am actually Dave White of Movies.com. You are Alonzo Duralde of TheRap.com and What the Flick.
Yes. And I have a new DVD column at MovieLine.com.
And
check
you have
it out.
A new DVD column at MovieLine.com. Check
every
it
Tuesday
out.
It's
every
called
Tuesday
High and
it's
Low.
It's called High and Low.
Stop repeating me.
Okay. I've noticed something. When we go out places, you and I,
mm-hmm.
together.
In the world.
Often you are playing me on the car stereo, other podcasts.
Uh-huh.
You force me to listen to other podcasts.
I don't force you to do anything.
On the car stereo, when in reality we should be listening to great music. But the one thing I'm noticing about the other podcasts that you force me to listen to.
They are not goofuses like us?
No. Often they are. But invariably, what they will often do, when I say invariably what they will often do, that didn't make any sense. What they will often do is tell the people who are listening to the show what kind of show they are. Like, for example, what if you're brand new to us this week and we just start talking like we always do?
Right.
We just start talking about stuff related to our lives. We don't even start talking about movies for at least 5 or 10 minutes.
At least.
Even though what we are is...
A movie podcast.
We're a movie podcast because we are film critics for a living. And also, we are a real-life married in California couple.
Yes.
So I think maybe somehow or other we just start announcing each week.
So besides
for
you
new
just saying
people,
linoleum knife, we need like a tagline that sort of
we
sums
did,
up
a little
the
explanation
thing.
Because like even on, what was it, the... What were we listening to this week? The Flophouse?
Yes.
They announce
yes.
who they are and what they are and what kind of podcast they are.
Right.
Each time. And it might help people who are listening for the first time.
Not turn us off immediately.
No, well, I mean, that's going to happen anyway. But I just think that maybe if people, maybe they should know.
Okay.
What we do and who, the thing that this is. What is this thing you're listening to? It's not about linoleum knives.
No.
That is simply a filmic reference.
True. We are not going to help
and,
you put a floor in your kitchen.
Yeah. So anyway.
Did I tell you, by the way, that
this is a thought for you to consider over the week and then realize I'm completely right.
No, no,
begin instituting.
I agree. I think it's a good idea. I think you should use to start working on what that tagline is.
No, we're not going to get a tagline. Just a little, you know.
Well, whatever. Just our, whatever our
here you are, and here's what we are.
Okay. I think that's a good idea. I like that idea. Did I tell you that our friend Kevin from Boston was telling me?
I don't have any Kevin named friends in Boston.
Yes, you do.
Oh, that Kevin in
yes.
Boston.
Yes.
All right.
That he went to, apparently they've been doing Rocky Horror at this one theater in Boston for a million years. And he went to the last screening because they were moving it to a different theater. And before the movie, they screened the intro from Aqua Teen Hunger Force : movie
oh, did they
for theaters.
Really? Yeah.
And he had the moment of revelation of, oh, that's what linoleum knife comes from. And he felt like, you know, he'd gotten an inside joke.
Like when Oprah has a spiritual revelation, she goes, aha.
Yes, just like that.
That's what Oprah does. Mm-hmm. I know this because I used to watch her show.
Oh,
she would always talk about how she'd have these spiritual revelations. And she'd go, I would think, aha. It's my moment of aha.
And then she would sing Take On Me.
Here's what I think happened with Oprah every day. I think every morning she woke up and looked at her checkbook and said, aha, still crazy rich. Everything else I think is spiritually correct.
I think she thought, ha ha, and then, like, softened it for television. Ha ha.
Movies.
Whoa, really? You're just
going
to go stampeding?
Here's the thing. We don't have... For the next few weeks, we need to cut to the chase, because we've got to catch up on listener mail.
Okay.
We've got yet another... I mean, not only did we get new mail in this week, but we're still catching up on our chronologically organized mail that I have put into its own special file.
Okay.
That we can address each person's concerns and top 10 lists and praise and criticism of us in a manner that isn't haphazard and doesn't take forever and doesn't leave anybody with sadness over never having their letter being read.
In addition to what we were talking about previously, what we're covering on the show this week,
yes,
we also need to talk about Todd Solondz's Dark Horse.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Expendables 2.
Yes.
Here's what's great about Expendables 2. The trailers for Taken 2, additional takings.
Retaken.
And... the trailer for Man with the Iron Fists.
Mm, that does look fun.
Yeah.
Written by RZA and Eli Roth.
I know. And directed by RZA.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be great.
I hope so.
I'm a big Eli Roth fan.
It's a fun trailer.
I've been a fan of the RZA for many, many years.
Really?
All the way back to Wu-Tang.
That's why you have that tattoo. Of the Wu-Tang.
That is why.
Some
yes. It's a tramp stamp. And
Dave White does not have any tattoos.
I do have a Wu-Tang.
Let's be clear.
I got the Wu-Tang tramp stamp.
Yes. Apart from the Wu-Tang.
And it's time everyone knew. I'm not going to be ashamed of it anymore. I was young.
It started out with the Wu-Tang logo, but since you put on weight, it now looks like Dark Phoenix back there.
Yeah, okay.
You don't even know what that is.
I have put on some weight.
So, Expendables 2. I did not see...
It starts in a city with a name you can't pronounce in a country you can't find on a map.
Right.
It's a Pishapong where Seth Agul
Ville
Nepal. And they drive in to this place, the Expendables come in and they're blowing up this place where women are being, you don't even know why, women are being dragged to the streets and there's tanks of eels
and they're all around. And they're polluting.
They're torturing some guy. It turns out that's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. There's some big sort of smelting forge going on that's spewing all this black smoke in the sky. It's like, not only are they, you know, torturers and kidnappers, but, you know, they're bad for the environment.
It's another day in Nepal.
Yeah.
With women being dragged by the hair and eels being curated for some special reason.
For Iron Chef Nepal. Yeah. That was the secret ingredient of the day.
They come in with these little, they're mini tanks, essentially. Like bulldozer tanky things.
With like girders sticking out the front to break through
things. And the girders all have funny little, you know, like
little things
painted boing on boing them. And, you know, goodbye and punch you in the face. You know, these little slogans written
like on the things they used to paint on the side of atomic bombs before they drew those, dropped them.
And then here's my favorite part about the opening moments. After my other favorite part, which was, of course, the trailer for Taken 2.
And Man with the Iron Fist.
And Man with the Iron Fist. As they're destroying this
compound,
den of miscreants.
It's always a compound.
They're yelling things at each other. The Expendables, who are all in different vehicles, I might add. Right. None of them are in the same car together or the same machine together. They're all yelling things to each other, like little jokey things, like, hey, what about the blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, okay, this is the same thing as Shia LaBeouf yelling, Optimus! He can't hear you. There's too many other noises happening. No one hears you when the world is ending.
Especially these old...
And there's a battle going on.
And these old guys are deaf anyway.
And these guys are all 72 years old. Chuck Norris is in this movie. Oh, man. He is 72 years old.
Has his voice always been that high registered?
I think back in the 80s.
He was more
doing like...
Because he's kind of like... Almost
like yesterday when you made me try to approximate the guy on the voiceover at the commercial. What was that?
No. The Friday nights on MSNBC.
Friday nights on... Yeah, the prison guy.
Yeah, as soon as Rachel Maddow's over and you go to prison, the guy says...
I forget what he says.
Oh.
Due to mature subject matter. Blah,
blah, blah, blah, yeah. Blah,
which is like... That would be me doing my Batman voice. Like, my own voice is like the way it is.
Right.
But that guy is like two cellars below me. That's a whole other level of resonance and depth.
Due to mature subject
matter. Yeah. I cannot approximate it. Mm. And for all I know, it's processed through some machine. Filter, because you can do that.
True.
What were we talking about? Oh, they're yelling at each other. And they're making jokes. They're cracking jokes, which are not funny at all. Sylvester Stallone has to step back from the jokes.
Yeah.
You know, understandably, these movies are meant to be somewhat tongue-in-cheek, you know, an over-the-top level of ridiculousness. But
when they go meta, its existence is that. Yeah.
A joke all by itself. You don't need to have them go, oh, wait, are you going to say yippee-ki-yay to me now? And Bruce Willis just looks at you like, oh, that sure was a funny thing that you said to me. Well, no, it wasn't. It's just dumb and doesn't make the movie better. What makes the movie better is extreme killing.
Yes. The inside jokes land with a thud. And there's a lot of them, like, you know, like Terry Crews tells Schwarzenegger if he doesn't get his gun back that he's going to terminate him.
He's like,
shut up. Yeah. Yeah. Shoot someone.
And so that stuff is terrible. Right. Like, and it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Really.
But not so much of it that it sinks the whole movie.
There's just enough of it to annoy you, a rock in your shoe. Everything else in this movie is real good.
It is super stupid fun, and that's really all I wanted it to be.
Everybody gets killed. Everybody gets their heads chopped off and shot in the face and axed and thrown out of windows. They drive tanky things through walls and, you know.
One guy manages to, like kill an entire army and a tank, you know.
Yeah, Chuck Norris, and it's who cares,
right?
If you know it's Norris. His big reveal of being in the movie is that he explodes a tank and kills a million people. All from one location, even though like all these people are all running around
from different angles.
Yeah, and so like he would have had to have created holograms of himself to cause this to happen. But
The movie actually does the thing where the young guy who wants to get married and is going to do one last mission. Guess what happens to him?
He gets sliced to pieces by Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is the hero, who's the villain. And he's really good at being a villain. I was hoping for a different outcome at the end.
Mm-hmm.
because I liked him so much as a villain?
Well, he could always have a twin, you know.
Right, okay.
In these movies.
We just kind of spoiled the ending, but...
who cares? Expendables 2, like you were really going in for surprise.
But yeah, there's tons of violence. It ain't the Raid.
No.
Because nothing, well, I haven't seen it yet, but nothing is the Raid. Which, by the way, is my DVD pick of the week, and I'll just get that out of the way right now. Fine. The Raid comes out on DVD.
The Raid Redemption.
The Raid Redemption, whatever.
Which people are going to look for.
The Raid colon Redemption comes out on DVD either out this past week, so it's already available.
Yeah.
When you hear the sound of my voice, your next object, your next action should be going to acquire a copy of The Raid colon Redemption and watch it after you see Expendables 2. Because you'll see Expendables 2, you'll be like, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then you'll see The Raid, and your brains will, like, drain out of your head. That's how great The Raid. Colon, who, what the?
Clean podcast.
The dog. The dog.
Again, it is somebody hot. Lives the windows
under,
are open.
Yeah, somebody lives underneath us now with a little terrible yappy dog.
Well, they have and two the dogs. Untrained, only one of them is yappy.
We live in untrained pet hell right now. The dog never stops barking.
Yeah, I'm sick of the parents of our generation and the dog owners of our generation who can't be bothered to discipline their little darlings.
Mm-hmm.
They're all getting on my nerves.
So, but yeah, just watch The Raid after The Expendables, because if you watch The Raid and then watch The Expendables, you'll say about Expendables, that's fine. That was fun, you know, because, you know, it's been months now since I've seen The Raid, so I've had time to recalibrate my expectations of an action movie.
Right.
And just accept, you know, the good amount of fun violence that exists in Expendables 2 as good, as plenty good. But the Raid is like, expendable words of William Bibbiani, that movie left me exhausted. And that's right, it will. That's how great it is. It'll make you tired. It's so full of stuff.
Speaking of movies that should be seen in a particular order, I think that I enjoyed Sparkle more than I maybe would have, because that morning I had watched the 70s original movie. I think the new one comes off much better by comparison in a lot of ways.
Well... it's a prettier movie to look at.
Well, for starters, yeah.
I mean, in this new one, they live in this gorgeous old house
in the suburbs of Detroit,
where there's like a nice lawn, and they've all got a variety of winter coats. Like every single one of them is like, oh, I'll wear this winter coat today because it matches my handbag. You know, they live in Oscar the Grouch's garbage can in the first movie. Like in the original film, they are poor.
The word ghetto is mentioned more than once.
Yeah, but this one, you know, obviously you like looking. I mean, I spent most of my time in Sparkle just looking at how prettily appointed their home was.
Sparkle is, like I said, it's a remake of a 70s movie. It is, the first movie predated Dreamgirls, although it's not exactly about the same story. In this one, three sisters. In the original, they lived in the Bronx or Harlem. In the new one, they live in Harlem. The new one, they live in the suburbs of Detroit. And basically, the middle daughter, or the young, no, actually, is she the middle or the youngest, Sparkle?
Sparkle's the baby of the family.
Sparkle's the youngest of three sisters.
Sister's the oldest. They say she's nearly 30,
right.
Or she is 30.
Yeah.
And then Dee, or in the original film, was called Dolores.
Yeah.
She's in the middle somewhere.
So Sparkle is a talented songwriter, but too shy to get on stage. Her oldest sister, who everyone calls sister, has no such compunctions, and so they're sort of.
She's a whore.
Well, but she loves the spotlight. Let's just say so they sort of build themselves as like a sister act, with sister like kind of leading the way, but Sparkle doing all the songwriting. Sister becomes sort of seduced by the lifestyle. And becomes a drug addict and an abused woman and a mess in general. And
married to Mike Epps.
They never get married. Like at the end of the movie.
They get married.
At the funeral, they, spoiler it, they still refer to her as her like fiance or whatever.
Oh, really?
They never actually get married.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Okay.
But basically, the whole movie is about how Sparkle sort of learns to stop hiding her light under a bushel and become, like, a singing sensation herself. Now, in the original, Irene Cara played Sparkle and Lonette McKee played Sister. And the songs are all by Curtis Mayfield. And here's the weird thing about the original movie. The soundtrack to the film is not really a soundtrack to the film because all the songs are sung by Aretha Franklin. And they're sung really well.
Hang on, you got to back up with some explanation here.
With a
voice. I'm going to interrupt you here.
Okay.
All right. But the original film from 76 is set in 1958.
Well, yes, there's that.
Hang on.
I hadn't gotten to that part.
Hang on. Well, that's essential.
Okay.
And everyone in the else in the movie, all the other singers and all the other music around them is all this doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-doo-doo-doo.
Love Potion number 9.
You know, yeah.
And then they come on stage.
And they come on stage with these Curtis Mayfield songs that were written in the early 70s for a film to be made and presented to the public in 1976. And it's the theme from Shaft. Like, it's 1958, and oh, suddenly Sister and her sisters have come to you from the future to sing songs that sound just like, you know, a song from the early 70s. There's been no Motown in between.
It's like
the doo-woppers and the funky people.
It's like in Dirty Dancing where they're dancing to, you know, Mickey and Sylvia, and then suddenly they're dancing to I've Had the Time of My Life, which is this very 1987 song.
Correct. And so things come from the future to change the world.
Right.
In the original film. They have smartly updated this movie to be
the late 60s.
The late 60s. Where early 70s sounding music is appropriate. It could have just been coming along.
And it's
and it could have sounded sort of revelatory.
It's orchestrated a little more period this time.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like dead on late 60s, but it's closer to the late 60s than the original movie's orchestrations were to the late 50s.
Yes.
Anyway, so the original movie, the soundtrack to the film is basically
not Irene Cara and not Lonette McKee.
It's all Aretha Franklin. It's like when they used to put out those albums, you know, like somebody wrote in a couple of weeks ago, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. sings the songs from Dr. Dolittle.
I can't wait until you buy a copy of that.
I am looking for one.
I know you are.
But, you know, so it's basically the soundtrack album for that film is Aretha Franklin sings the songs from Sparkle, although she does not sing them in the movie Sparkle.
And, you know, Irene Cara is a very nice singer.
Yes. And as is Lonette McKee.
Very nice singer. Do you know who neither of them can sing as well as?
I'm going to say Aretha Franklin.
Correct. Do you know who nobody can sing as well as?
I'm going to say Aretha Franklin.
Maybe not now. Okay, Aretha Franklin is now very old.
Yes.
And her voice has considerably changed her singing ability and her
Christmas album from a couple years ago was not a revelation.
She's a different kind of singer now. But in the 60s and 70s, the height of her powers, it is enough.
She was young, gifted, and black.
It is enough, exactly. It is enough to send chills down your spine to this day. If all you've heard of Aretha Franklin is the songs you've heard, and you haven't heard anything else, if all you've ever heard is respect and you
Chain
make me feel
fools.
Like a natural woman and, you know, think and Chain of Fools or whatever,
go deep catalog.
Go listen to some. Listen to what this woman did. Because
Find the Aretha Franklin Sings Dinah Washington album.
One of the great singers of all time.
Yeah.
Like, of recorded history. One of the great voices. So it's unfair to have her sing the songs from that movie ever, because here's what's going to happen. They're going to put out
it's
a soundtrack.
Like, it's like if they told Nicole Kidman, hey, we're going to get Barbara Streisand to do the album. I hope you're okay with that.
Right. They're going to put out a soundtrack album to this.
Yeah,
Jordan Sparks
they have,
singing
sure.
the songs, and it's going to be fine because she's a naturally gifted young girl.
Right.
She's a very nice singer, and she does these songs proud.
Yes.
In the movie. She's good at delivering her version of the song.
Yes. Whitney Houston wisely does not attempt to do
any of the
Aretha Franklin songs.
We're going to get to her in a second.
Yes.
But do you know who Jordan Sparks doesn't sing as well as?
I'm going to say Aretha Franklin.
Again, correct. this is a problem for me. I have had the Sparkle soundtrack album for years. I know these songs, and I know them because of Aretha Franklin. And I know how they're supposed to sound in my head because of Aretha Franklin. So that took me away. I mean, I'm good enough at my job as a professional to accept things as they are.
See, this is
however, it's Aretha Franklin.
This is how we can tell that you're not a Broadway guy.
What?
Because, like, the great Broadway musicals get revived, and different singers do them, and same different singers.
Same with opera. There's
right, bingo.
Maria Callas does La Traviata, and somebody else Joe does Sutherland La Traviata. Does it, I know.
But I'm just saying, though, it's something that you have to, you know, like, you have to kind of weigh, like, you know, how does Merman's Mama Rose differ from Patti LuPone's, differ from Tyne Daly's, differ from Bernadette Peters's, you know?
And if Aretha Franklin had been Mama Rose on Broadway in the 60s and 70s, all the rest of those women would have been like, oh yeah, those are good. Oh, here's Aretha Franklin. I'm right.
Wow, that's an alternate history I would like to see.
I'm right. Am I not right?
An all-black gypsy with Aretha Franklin playing Mama Rose.
Exactly.
Would be pretty amazing.
So anyway, where was I going with this? Okay, here's my other problem with this. That isn't really a problem with this film, because I'm being unfair if I compare
it. Yeah, Jordan Sparks' singing is not the issue here. Yeah.
Jordan Sparks' acting is the problem here. But also her performing the songs, any song. She is a competent actress. She doesn't embarrass herself. She doesn't sink the movie.
She's not Mariah Carey in Glitter.
She can walk and talk at the same time. Much like Christina Aguilera in Burlesque. She can walk and talk at the same time, does not embarrass herself.
Although the fact that her character is named Sparkle does bring up the thing from Screening Party that Glitter would have been better if the Mariah Carey character had been named Glitter.
Here is the problem with Jordan Sparks in this film. She needs that support, and she's given that support by all the supporting cast around her. Derek Luke, who is her boyfriend in the film and acts circles around her.
Totally.
Tika Sumpter, who I don't really know much about other than that she was on Gossip Girl and on that show The Game.
She's done a lot of TV.
She plays Dolores D., the middle sister, and walks away with every scene she's in.
Oh, man. She is ferocious.
She's got so much sass in this movie. It's like she invented it. It is definitely an attention-getting performance. Yeah. Like, you walk away from that going, who's that girl?
Right.
You really walk out of the theater. You don't walk away out of the theater thinking, wow, Jordan Sparks is a star now. You walk out of the theater thinking,
Who played that middle sister?
Yeah. You want to see more of her.
Yes.
I'm going to go put The Game in TiVo and start watching The Game. If she's in it, I want to see what she does in that show. If they're still showing. I don't know if it's on the air anymore. They may be showing
it. It might be on Netflix or something.
But,
Carmen Ejogo is
she's good too.
Mike Epps.
In spite of being a perfectly good singer, Jordan Sparks doesn't have the stuff inside her to deliver a musical performance with anything that you can feel. You know, there's nothing there yet. She's too young to do anything more than to impress you with her technical note-hitting abilities. She hasn't experienced great highs or lows in her life. You can tell. She's just been raised comfortably and happily by a comfortable, happy family, and then she got on this reality show and won and became, you know,
more famous.
And points are not life. Her reference points are The Little Princess and The Lion King. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
The Little Mermaid.
The Little Mermaid and The Lion King and stuff like that.
She is grit-free.
Yeah. And I have a problem with that. You know, anyone who knows me knows that there's no such thing as American Idol if it's not Fantasia Barrino.
Well, yes.
And so that's, I mean, obviously that's what I respond to more. Give me a girl that's been through it and is screaming at me.
As Randy Jackson would say, Jordan Sparks sings, but she does not sang.
Correct.
And that definitely bleeds over into her acting. And she's playing a character who is writing songs in a period of cultural tumult.
Right.
You know, there's a war in Vietnam, there's riots in Detroit, there's a civil rights movement going on, you know, there's sex and murder and whatever happening around her, and she just never stops being like Disney Channel majorette.
She's a goody-two-shoes girl, and that's appropriate for her character because she wants to please her mother, Whitney Houston.
Yes.
Who's a stern, church-going lady with a past.
Yes.
And, but there's just, I mean, you would think that if she were internally rebelling somehow, needing to get out all of this deep stuff that she has inside her, she would be writing songs that were different than the ones that are in the movie.
you know?
Because the ones in the movie, they're just love songs.
Yeah.
She writes a lot of love songs. And one somewhat salacious love song.
Right.
You know, giving him something he can feel.
that En Vogue would later cover.
Yeah.
It's an odd choice. I mean, like, it's almost like I wish they had gotten a better actress to play the role and then maybe put out a new Sparkle album of Jordan Sparks singing the songs the way that Aretha did. I don't know. So, but it doesn't, she's a perfectly competent singer, does not have the chops to play this character and to go on the journey that this character goes on, and is definitely not keeping up with the very strong ensemble that director Salim Akil, is that his name?
Yes.
Has surrounded her with. And he directed Jumping the Broom a few years ago, which is a very funny movie.
Like 2 years ago. Yeah.
And
which is a really funny movie.
It is.
If you avoided it thinking that it was a Tyler Perry kind of comedy.
It is not.
It's not. It's a really funny wedding comedy.
Yeah.
And
Loretta Devine.
Check it out.
Loretta Devine gets to play a character who is not like a Sunday church lady, like who gets angry and is like has a chip on her shoulder and is, you know, bitter and about
ruins
things.
Everything.
Yeah, it's really fun to watch because like she so often just plays the like, amen,
yeah.
Praise him, you know, and so like she really gets to play with some areas of her Crayola box that doesn't usually, you know, we don't get to see on screen.
All right, tell me your feelings about Whitney Houston in this movie, and I will tell you my contradictory feelings about Whitney Houston
in
this movie.
I think, first of all, it's a strong performance. I think she's really good in it, and it's a reminder that she is a really compelling screen presence. Like, I mean, I think The Bodyguard's a crap movie, and I'm not a big fan of The Preacher's Wife either, but she has that thing. Like, you can tell why they legitimately thought she had the potential to be a big movie star because she is a beautiful woman and she really like is very self-possessed on camera.
Mm-hmm.
I know what you're going to object to, and I'll
let
you
never believe her as happy and kind. You really ever believe her as scorned and brutal, but that's still good.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what she has in this movie. Like this is a woman who had, you know, as we come to find out, she had attempted a show business career of her own.
She was great at being mean to people.
Yeah. she had attempted a show business career of her own. It went disastrously. She had addiction issues and, you know, got her life together, is now, you know, very church-going lady, mm-hmm. raising her daughters with a very firm hand. And I found it really compelling. There are some moments that were obviously intended to sort of, you know, I mean, they work for the character, but they're kind of meant, it's almost like it's an Expendables 2 type of, you know, self-referential thing.
Yes.
It didn't bother me so much. Dave had an issue with it, and I'll let him tell you about it. But there was nothing that happened with her that took me out of the movie. I wasn't constantly looking at it and thinking, oh, God, she's dead. It's so sad. I mean, it is sad that she's dead, but I mean, I was able to just sort of go with it. I think part of it is that it's period, so I wasn't thinking about contemporary Whitney that much. And part of it is how, speaking of screening party, like when we watched The Bodyguard, I made the joke about, I said, watching Whitney Houston in this movie is like watching like Katharine Hepburn in the 30s, except that The Bodyguard wasn't made 70 years ago. You know, so in a way, I don't know how to say this without saying it. I think Whitney Houston to me was so doomed for so long that by the time she actually physically died, it was almost like kind of inevitable, I guess. I don't know. So I guess when I watch her in this film, I think she looks so put together. She looks so in control of herself.
Yes.
That it's like watching something from a long time ago, for me anyway.
Oh, okay. I understand what you're saying now. Yeah. Unfortunately, she's dead.
Unfortunately, she's dead.
And I'm stunned that they left some of that dialogue in the movie. And maybe they meant to leave it in the movie to make it feel as painful as it feels.
Maybe.
Because there's a moment in this film where her singing career, the character's singing career, has been destroyed by her own addictions.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, cleaned up, as you said. There's one point where she says to her daughters, "Was my life not enough of a cautionary tale for you?" And that just feels like a crushing ton of bricks landing on your head. It's too much for the movie to bear. It's painful to hear. It took me right out of seeing it, of watching it as a film. All I could think from that moment on was, that's a dead person talking to me. And then at the end, when she's in church and she's singing, "His eye is on the sparrow," that's like a funeral song. Okay, I mean, they sing it a lot in black churches, but like the context I've always heard it in, sung in black churches, is in a funeral context. If you recall,
yes,
when we went to the funeral of our friend Andy, mm-hmm. and the choir,
film critic Anderson Jones,
when the choir who sadly passed away of a heart attack at age 38, we went to his funeral. And the choir sang "His Eyes on the Sparrow."
The reason that Dave
so badly.
The reason that Dave's laughing is so they were badly. Terrible.
Yeah, they were terrible.
And it was at that moment we realized Hollywood had been lying to us all these years. We thought every black church choir was amazing.
Because TV and movies told us this.
Turns out there are some crappy ones.
And the reason I'm laughing is because of that just craziness. And I just sat there. I remember thinking, sitting there in the funeral as that poor woman was just destroying that song, that if Andy had been actually sitting in this funeral with us, he would have been
merciless.
He would have been merciless and sassing her loudly in an outdoor voice. Because that's the kind of guy he was.
He'd be in the third row going, "Ugh."
And so it was crazy that day.
Did you think of Houston's rendition of it?
Great.
Apart from
she sang the song really well. She sounded like the somewhat damaged version of herself.
Right.
And as we were talking after the film, you know, it takes a lot of crack to ruin a voice like that. Because that, again, one of the greatest voices of the 20th century. Right up there with Aretha Franklin.
Absolutely.
And Judy Garland and Billie Holiday and all that. I mean, the power and the ability of her in her prime in the 80s. There was no one else in that decade that sang like her. So anyway, I couldn't watch this movie without constantly thinking about, there's a dead person talking to me now. And it just felt it's too heavy for the movie to carry. The movie's such a lightweight little nothing of a movie that it's not designed to have that much tragedy, real life tragedy, heaped on top of it.
I guess maybe I watch more TCM than you do, and I'm just used to seeing more movies that where everybody's dead, and
well,
so
they all died of natural causes.
Well, I know, not necessarily. James Dean didn't, you know.
Well, but I mean, that's a long time ago.
I know what you're saying. That it didn't happen
6 months ago.
Yes, I understand that, but I guess at some point, from my brain, a dead person in a movie, even if it's a freshly dead person in a movie, is just, I don't know. It didn't bug me. It didn't take me out of it. And I think that the movie has a real energy to it. I love the
I'm going to feel the same pain when I watch Breaking Dawn Part 2. I know only love has died.
But nonetheless. I love the way that Sparkle looks. You know, you mentioned the costumes.
There's a lot of costumes and a lot of wigs. If that's your thing,
I know
it is for some of you out there.
Yes.
You're gonna like that stuff because there are costume change montages.
Yes,
in this
which
movie.
There had better be, frankly, for a movie that's in this era. I demand one.
There's a really clever one that happens in the middle of a singing performance, yeah. which I thought was really great.
Yeah.
That's actually, I think, my favorite, aside from every moment that Tika Sumpter is smart mouthing somebody.
Right.
That's my favorite thing in the film.
But yeah. The sets look great. I like the way they move the camera around and do that.
It's a really good looking movie.
Yeah, I got
on every level, just the production design and the cinematography, the way he directs is nice. Yeah.
I got carried along with it. I think the script, again, you know, especially when you compare it to the original movie, it's like the original movie, the characters do things that aren't really explained very well. And in this movie, it's like, okay, we're going to let the same things happen, but we're going to go in and actually make a reason why.
Give you details for the things that are
actually, like, we're going to buttress these barely, you know, conceived characters and turn them into something that resembles three dimensions.
They,
And then, unfortunately, they run out of Curtis Mayfield songs, and then we get these new R. Kelly songs.
And I like R. Kelly.
R. Kelly should not write PG-13.
He's my favorite R&B urinator. But these songs are
Jordan Sparks did not sing Sex in the Kitchen.
These songs are sub I Believe I Can Fly kind of stuff. In fact, there's one actually, the big song at the end is called One Wing. As in, I can't fly with just one wing.
Which earlier in the film is basically is an excuse that somebody uses to snort cocaine, but somehow they turn it into this big spiritual uplifting thing at the end. Which
she takes you know, ugliness and turns it into beauty. That's the whole point.
She makes it sparkle.
Yeah, she makes cocaine addiction
sparkle.
Here's something I did really like about Jordan Sparks and her character. Mm. She has no heart.
she is always closing.
She is always, like, they can be in the lowest point of their despair and problem. And the first thing out of her mouth is, how is this going to affect my career? It is so funny to listen to her and to watch her priorities in the film.
But what about the show tonight?
She is, yeah, what's going to happen to the show tonight? You know, like, if someone's collapsed dead on the floor. She's like,
we need to be at the club in 45 minutes.
This is gonna be really bad for me. So I thought that was pretty funny. And again, just the cleanliness of everything was really great.
It is a very,
even their dressing rooms are pretty.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest lie of all.
Totally. Yeah. This is a very well scrubbed Detroit. You know, there's mention of riots, but we never see one. It's because everything is gleaming and candy colored, and you know.
Okay, we've talked too much about this. Paranorman.
Okay, Paranorman is awesome.
Yeah, it is.
It's a 3D animated film from Laika Studios, the folks that did Coraline. And this might even be more technically proficient in a way.
I think
it's like I haven't been reading the articles. You know, I don't follow the tech stuff. But I think this is like sort of the next gen of 3D stop motion animation. It's about a kid who can commune with the dead.
Yes.
Norman sees ghosts everywhere, and they can talk to him, and he can talk to them, and nobody else believes him, and so he's kind of an outcast. And he lives in a small town where a witch was condemned to death 300 years earlier, and they've sort of exploited that as kind of a tourist trap thing. But the witch who was executed laid a curse on her tormentors and the town, and it may come to destroy them all unless Norman can save the day. It's a really cool little movie, and it's a spooky movie, and I think like very little kids should not see it because it's too scary for them probably. But you know, if you know your kids and you know their tolerance level for this sort of thing, if they like scary stuff and they aren't going to wig out, take them. It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's technically beautiful. It just everything about it is the animation is gorgeous. The 3D is great. It's witty, it's smart.
Really good voice casting.
It's got this great sort of, you know, satirical tone that is sort of like a crueler version of The Simpsons, even, I'd say.
Right. The underside of mass hysteria.
And, you know, sort of less adorable Nightmare Before Christmas sort of atmosphere. And the idea of people not learning lessons from history is all throughout it. And the people in the town are so stupid and worthless. And it's because they're the direct descendants of these people who burned the witch.
Right.
And so...
And it's also a movie basically about how fear makes us do really, really stupid things. You know, whether it's bullying, whether it's, you know, shunning, you know, outsiders or people who are different. You know, it's rare that movies will really kind of call out that kind of behavior as you're afraid. That's you're doing this because you're afraid.
I will say that is the one part of the movie that got on my nerves.
Too much of it for you?
At the end of the film, there's too much sermonizing. There's a little bit too much, you know, you're afraid of things you don't understand, and that's why you're mean, and it's not right to do that because you're afraid of things you don't understand, and that's mean, and it's not right for you to do that because you're afraid of things.
Okay,
it's that. They do that a lot toward the end, and it got on my nerves. I was hoping for, you know, funnier stuff to be said or wittier stuff to be said. It gets very heartfelt and very teachy at that moment.
I didn't think it was too much, but
Fair enough. That was just a little too much for me. Otherwise, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like I don't remember what star rating I gave it on the site, but big, many, lots of them. Mm-hmm. Four and a half, something like that. I really loved it. But at the same time, I wish it had had a stronger big climax, because the big climax is that big long speech. And I wished it had not been so much of that. Hmm. And maybe I'm just getting fatigued on, and this is going to sound horrible, and I don't mean it to sound horrible.
You're horrible.
No. I'm getting a little fatigued on what I'm now perceiving to be the corporatization of the anti-bullying message. Let me explain.
Go on.
I was in the mall the other day. I was finally catching up on seeing Killer Joe, which is real good, by the way. And I was having some dinner after, because I had to go straight from Killer Joe to, I don't remember now what, something else. But in between, I had to get some food. So I stopped at the food court in the mall to get something. And there's, you know, these video screens now in every food court. You text a number to the video screen.
And they'll play Call Me Maybe.
It'll play Call Me Maybe for you. And, well, there's this, it's like some teenage marketed deodorant. I don't know which one, but they've got an anti-bullying campaign now. And they've recruited all these bands, you know, these stupid little nothing bands.
That didn't exist 15 minutes ago,
to sit all down in front of a camera and look at it sort of like, you want us to talk about bullying now? It's real bad. We were told by our manager we had to be here. And they've got a campaign now, and the campaign is Mean Stinks. Get it? Buy Teen Spirit.
You know what?
And I'm for anti-bullying messages in the culture. I am absolutely for that. But if they feel false to me, they still feel false to me. And that feels kind of weird and false to me.
It's weird that you bring this up, because we've been catching up on...
Because we're going to get burned out on this as an idea, no, if that's what starts happening.
I understand.
We're going to forget that people really are, you know, hurting each other, and kids really are killing themselves over this kind of thing if we turn it into a way to sell deodorant.
Granted. That's gross.
That's where I was going. That.
But it's weird. Like, I've been
watching... I'm not accusing Paranorman of being a part of that.
I understand.
I'm just saying it's getting to be in a lot of places now.
It's a better bullying movie than Bully was.
That's a... Wait, which Bully are we talking about?
Not the Larry Clark.
The awesome Larry Clark movie?
No, the documentary.
I didn't even see that.
Oh, well then.
Yeah.
It's funny that you bring up the deodorant campaign, because we've been watching Mad Men of late, and... There's that scene where they go on the picnic and then they leave all of their litter and crap on the hillside.
Yes, yes.
And it just reminded me about how, like, we grew up in an era where they actually had to start doing those PSAs to tell
stop throwing your trash on the road.
Yeah, stop throwing your crap out the window.
Make the Native American man cry.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, remember when people used to have, like, that little plastic bag that would hang on the knob of the of the glove compartment, like the little trash bag,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, and then throw it out the window.
Right. Yeah, when it got full. But that was a thing. And like, and people had to sort of be actively kind of told, look, you can't do this anymore. Like, you've been doing it all your life and you haven't thought twice about it. So I think that bullying has finally kind of fallen into the category of like, someone has to actually say, you really can't do this anymore. Like, it's not cool.
I guess.
There are ramifications and there are, you know, effects of
this. And the difference is that when we were kids and they were doing all of the anti-littering campaigns, Woodsy the Owl and, you know, Pitch In and and all that stuff. Those were public service announcements.
Right.
They weren't tied into a deodorant. Buying a product.
No, I that part of it I'm not going to quibble with. But I'm just saying, I'm all for getting it out there in the culture. Maybe not connected to a product, but I'm all for having the conversation and talking about it. Because, you know, when we were kids, it was like, oh, well, boys will be boys. You just have to, you know, learn to fight back. And, you know, like, it was never a good answer on that one. So, anyway, Paranorman, it's great. Go see it.
Wait, I think I just found out. It's Secret deodorant.
Is it just for ladies? For young ladies?
Hang on. Well, I'm looking at the thing now.
Isn't it pH balance just for her?
It's the Procter & Gamble Secret. It's for teenage girls sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, because teenage girls are the worst when it comes to bullying.
I don't know. They've.
I'm kidding.
I think they have equal.
They're all evil. Yeah. Little monsters should all be shipped off somewhere. Yeah.
So, what's the other movie?
Cosmopolis.
So great. Cosmopolis is so great. And
this is the movie that I think that's
press screening. There were walkouts of the press at the press.
Oh, really? I didn't notice. This is the movie that's going to bite us in the ass most for liking it because people are going to be like, man, I can't believe it.
I don't care. Look, I stand behind what I stand behind. I recommended Todd Haynes's Safe to our friends Pete and his wife Catherine. And they watched it. And they watched it going on 20 years ago now and have not forgiven me to this day. They're like, you always steer us right, except for that one. It was so boring.
Ugh, fools.
And that's really always the criticism. When you recommend a movie that has a very sort of slow vibe and a creepy sort of burn attached to it.
A slow, complex narrative.
You don't. It can often read as boring if you're not the kind of person that wants to deal with that kind of thing. And it doesn't make you a bad person or dumb. Maybe it makes you a little dumb.
remember the whole debate last year when Tree of Life came out?
I was going to say, it might make you a little dumb.
Maybe a little. Yeah. The whole thing about the in defense of the boring movie and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
This is that.
Robert Pattinson sits in a real tricked out limo.
For almost the entire film. He is a young billionaire, hotshot, whiz kid, master of the universe type. And is trying to get across Manhattan to get a haircut and keeps getting delayed by a presidential motorcade and an anarchist riot in the street and a funeral for a Sufi rapper. And people keep popping in and out of the car to talk about business and the future and the way the world works. And periodically he gets out of the limo and has meals with his wife who doesn't want to have sex with him. And he encounters various nemeses. And, yeah, it's based on a book by Don DeLillo.
But some people do want to have sex with him.
Yes.
And they do it in the car.
Yes, yeah. Just not his wife. It's based on a novel by Don DeLillo. And David Cronenberg, who wrote and directed, makes no effort to open it up, as they say. He keeps it in the limo.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's a talky movie. And it's a talky Cronenberg movie, so everyone talks like this.
Remember when we saw Crash for the first time? And we spent the whole next day at home talking like this to one another.
Are we out of Cheerios?
Yes, we are.
Next time.
Maybe next time.
Next time. So yeah, it's one of those movies. Nonetheless, if you are like... You know, you might want to be caffeined up when you go into this because it's a movie that demands your attention.
Yes.
But if you are willing to do the work, you know, do the heavy lifting that this movie sort of demands that you do to follow what's going on and to catch the little clues that are being, you know, seeded throughout about who the characters are and what they're after and what the point of it all is. I found it really fascinating.
I did too, and it reminded me so much of Crash in so many ways that I couldn't help but just attach that love, you know, to sure. it as well. I think that the car parallel is so strong, and the idea of what cars do for people and to people,
and
the
idea of the car as an extension of the self.
Yeah. And the idea of humans and machines becoming one thing, which is such a big deal for Cronenberg.
Sure, yeah.
That
the new flesh.
That this just feels like almost. It feels like Crash's cousin of the future, and I'm a gigantic fan of Crash, and I mean we've talked about it so many times already on this podcast how much we love that movie.
The Cronenberg Crash, mind you, not the crappy.
Yeah, yeah, not the racism Crash, the sex and car accidents Crash.
Yes.
The cars do different things in films, and I said this a lot. I talked to him. This is the basis of how I reviewed the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like what does a tricked out limo mean? And what it really means is it's either something really just dumb and tacky, like Dolly Parton's big white limousine. Mm-hmm. For the Real Housewives to ride around in, or you know, prom kids to ride around in,
to put their stick their heads out of the sunroof and go woo.
Faith Hill goes to the CMA Awards. It's also a thing for really rich people, and the idea of like really rich people still attaching themselves to this wasteful, ridiculous thing.
It is both womb and tomb.
Yeah, and that's exactly he treats it as sort of a death chamber in this movie. But it's in keeping with cars in film history. And I said in my review, it's like, well, if you're Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or Herbie, you're a pet. And if you're, you know, if you're in Death Race 2000,
you're a weapon.
You're a weapon. If you're in Two Lane Blacktop, you're like a symbol of hopelessness and ennui. You know,
existential angst,
absurdist sort of car pileups in Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend.
Right.
And so, like, the idea of a human being so attached to a car has been done in so many ways. And now, by Cronenberg himself, in ways where people are seemingly courting death, but actually looking for new levels of existence in Crash.
Right.
To where this guy never wants to get out of the car, and the car moves very slowly. It's never really going to crash into anything. No. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to get attacked and destroyed from outside forces.
Right.
And you know, the idea of it as a cocoon, but also the thing that separates you and is going to actually like eliminate you from the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it works on so many of those different, you know, levels and themes that he's explored before. And the idea of how it's also a really interesting adaptation because he only adapts movies. You ever think the books and plays and stuff that he adapts are always like really tough, you know, to turn into a linear narrative, you know, like Naked Lunch and True. Crash and now this.
Well, I mean, M. Butterfly is fairly all right. linear, all but right. but it's yeah. but it's still tricky to do visually on right. the screen. History of Violence is an adaptation.
Yeah.
It was a comic book.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually the most straightforward of them all, I think.
Yeah.
And it's also really amazing. Oh, speaking of, can we be done talking about this? Did you notice how the end of Killer Joe is very similar to the end of A History of Violence? They're all sitting around eating a meal. Now, obviously, the end of Killer Joe, the meal becomes
something else.
Insane.
You know what? I can't at this moment remember the ending of the end of violence is. So we'll have to talk about
the ending of A History of Violence is them all. Violence. Everything has come to a close. All of the violence has been accomplished.
Oh, right.
And they're all just passing the potatoes.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
And the end of Killer Joe, it begins with the passing of the potatoes.
Right, and then it descends into...
And I love how they call it the K-Fried C. Like, they keep calling it the K-Fried C because you know that they tried to get Kentucky Fried Chicken to sign on to this movie.
You're doing what with our product? No.
He also talked about Killer Joe a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, and I just now saw it. I'm going to write a review for the site. It'll go up this week.
Okay. Remind me. I'll link it on our page.
But it's tremendous, and maybe next to The Raid, one of the most physically brutal films I've seen all year.
Mm.
And in very real ways, it's more brutal than The Raid because
it's more intimate.
The violence is more intimate, and it. And I will say this as a warning, just the way they warned the audience before I saw the film, the guy at Landmark.
Really?
Usher, you know how the usher comes out at Landmark and says, "You're about to see William Friedkin's Killer Joe, blah, blah, blah."
Rated NC-17.
Rated NC-17. And he actually says, "There is unsettling violence in this film. You should be warned now."
You know,
if you have a problem with that kind of thing, be warned that there is unsettling violence in this film. And it's not just that it's extreme violence, it's sexual violence.
Right, right.
And that's really, and maybe it's smart to warn people.
No, sure.
So maybe we should do that too. There's sexual violence in this film. If that is a thing that you cannot watch in a movie, then this is not the film for you. However, if you can watch this sort of thing in a movie, and you can admire...
You can distance yourself from...
The audacity of the filmmaking and the actors involved.
Oh, yeah.
Gina Gershon, in another world, in another universe, she'd get a Best Supporting Actress nomination for this film.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's not only that good, but goes there in a way that I have not seen in maybe years.
It is an exceedingly brave performance. I was raving about her. She puts herself out there the way very few actresses would, I think, and in a lot of the film, in a lot of different ways. And, yeah, I admire her so much. I think she's so great and so just fearless.
And not just because she's Crystal Connors.
Not just
although
she's
that helps.
Connors, totally. She's extraordinary. But, no, getting back to Cosmopolis real quick.
Yeah.
Pattinson. What do you think?
I think that... Much like in Crash, with people like James Spader and Elias Koteas, and most of all,
Deborah Kerr Unger,
so good at being a blank that he comes off perhaps sometimes to a lot of people as untalented.
Well, that's the thing. I can't tell yet. I haven't seen him in enough stuff that I can't tell if he's dialing it down or if he's Keir DeLay. Like who Kubrick intentionally cast in 2001 because he was had so little on the page.
I know, but I don't think that's what this is. I don't think we're dealing with Keanu Reeves here. Because seriously, after all these years, Keanu Reeves, what's he like in a movie? You know what he's like in a movie.
No, true. But I mean, did you get anything out of like Bellamy or
such a rotten movie.
Or Little Ashes? That's the thing. I haven't seen enough Pattinson yet to really gauge if this is him... What he's doing, or if it's just they're exploiting the fact that he's got nothing.
You know? I felt like that in the Reese Witherspoon circus movie.
Oh, yeah.
That he was fine.
He was actually, yeah.
And
but pretty,
but
laid back.
Laid back, yeah. And I don't think it's wrong to say that some actors have that quality,
mm-hmm.
and he has that quality.
Sure.
That sort of like
whispery.
You know.
Whatever it is, he does it right.
Whatever it is, they've played completely to his strengths in this movie. So
he can wear a suit.
Twilight stuff does not bother me in terms of those people. Like I don't think that the badness of 50% of the Twilight films, the second and the third, for the record, is indicative of what kind of actors these people are.
No, but I'd say with almost all of them, except for ones that I like Peter Facinelli, say, who I've seen on Nurse Jackie or whatever, with a lot of them, I am sort of keeping the jury out. Like all these people are talking about, oh, Taylor Lautner, he's so terrible. I'm like, I need to see him in one. I like he was pretty bad in that kidnap movie, whatever it was called. But I'm pretty
bad.
But
okay, you're being nice.
He was awful. But yeah. I need to give him like two or three non Twilight movies before I make up my mind.
The problem with that kid.
And also to like
see, we don't know if he's a good actor.
And to see what the years do. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like even you know, like Kristen Stewart, we're starting to get enough other things, you know, The Runaways, and she's got On the Road coming out.
She was cool as Joan Jett in that movie.
But she was terrible as Snow White.
Whatever.
But I'm fine. I'm just saying. But yeah, you're right. Based on the Twilight movies, we can't
get. The problem with Snow White is that you're forced to accept a lot of things that just aren't real. Well, yeah. So the I don't want to talk about that. I just, you know, but back to Cosmopolis. Uh-huh. Fine. He's good. He's okay. Good. He's good because he's asked to do things that he's good at doing, and he's directed well toward that performance.
Yeah, it's in his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And I was going to talk real quick about Beloved, which is the reason that I played.
How many minutes are we?
65.
65?
Yeah, I'll be short.
Yeah, we're going to save Dark Horse again then.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's making a slow way across the country.
Yeah, anyway. It's not like you're going to miss it.
Yeah.
So.
Or unless you already have. Beloved is a new French film directed by Christophe Honoré, who did Dans Paris.
Dans Paris and Love Songs.
And Love Songs.
I really like Dans Paris.
I was not a big fan.
D-A-N-S, Paris.
Yeah, in Paris.
It's a Christmas movie that I really think is just moving and just heartfelt and wonderful.
I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. And then this new one is about a mother and a daughter, and I think the mother's story is fascinating, and the daughter's story is crazily implausible, and I never got interested in it, and the whole second half of the movie is the daughter's story. So it drove me up the wall.
And it's the reason you played The Young Girls of Rochefort.
Yes, because it stars Catherine Deneuve.
And she sings.
And she sings, and she sings for herself. She also sings for herself in Eight Women. She just didn't sing for herself.
And in Dancer in the Dark.
Right, but not in Young Girls of Rochefort and not in Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Correct.
The film begins with Emmanuel Seigner, who played Deneuve's daughter in Eight Women. She was also in Water Drops on Burning Rocks and Swimming Pool as a young woman who works in a shoe store. And one night she sneaks out a pair of sexy red heels and is mistaken for a prostitute and starts a side gig.
You know how these things happen.
As one does. But, you know, as she says proudly, like, you know, I always had receipts. I always had a legitimate day job. You know?
I see that you were dressed like a whore. Perhaps you would enjoy some money for whoring.
So, anyway, she has various Johns, one of whom is a doctor who is visiting from Prague to study and falls in love with her and she with him. And they get married and she goes to Prague with him.
You're taking too long. Speed it up.
Okay, anyway.
Listener mail.
Okay, so eventually Emmanuel Seigner grows up to be Catherine Deneuve, and the daughter that she has with the Czech doctor is played by Chiara Mastroianni, who is the daughter in real life of Deneuve and of Marcello Mastroianni, who are two of like the great iconic faces in cinema ever.
Yeah, yes.
And she, depending on which angle you look at her from, looks like both of them.
Correct.
And is an extraordinary actress, and she's great, and I love her, and I wish that her story in the movie weren't so ridiculously implausible, involving her being completely smitten with Paul Schneider, who plays a gay drummer, and the movie drags in AIDS and 9/11, and it gets just ridiculous. But the Deneuve stuff is great. The Czech doctor grows up to be Miloš Forman, which is kind of a cool bit of casting. Anyway, it's a mess. The parts that work I liked a lot, but most of it left me cold. So, sorry, Beloved. I loved the trailer, but you kind of disappointed me.
Is it better than 9/11?
It is better than
9/11. Is it better than AIDS?
Much better than
okay, this. Well then, maybe you might want to go see it after all. I'm going to go see it, just because I want to see the new film by Christophe Honoré.
Okay, well, knock yourself out.
Yeah. All right, mail.
Okay, we get letters.
This, again, we're still catching up from June.
Yes.
All right. Kevin from Ottawa.
We're going to put off Sight and Sound, too, until we have more time.
Kevin from Ottawa. I've been a listener of your podcast for a few months now. It has become a staple of my Monday mornings, and it's maybe the only reason I actively look forward to Mondays now.
Aww. Thank you.
Anyway, here are my current 10 favorite films. The list is very loose, and these 10 films are pretty interchangeable with one another. Dawn of the Dead.
The original?
The original one.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
The General.
Not my. We've talked about this, yes. I think. Yeah, not my favorite Keaton, but okay, fine.
Paris, Texas. I love Paris,
beautiful,
Texas.
Beautiful, sad
really
movie.
Vim Vendors film from the early 80s. Sans Soleil, Chris Marker.
Hated it in college. Need to see it again.
Inland Empire. I think it's such a crazy David Lynch movie.
The bus costs $3.50.
Magnolia.
Okay. You call me lady?
Persona.
Sure.
Harakiri.
Haven't seen it.
In Japanese, Seppuku. Kobayashi movie from 1962. And No Country for Old Men, just great.
Sure.
And Hannah and Her Sisters.
Love it.
What percent of knife do we call this? You don't like The General?
The General and Sans Soleil, not my favorites. But I know I'm in the minority on those.
You are in the minority on those.
Have you seen either of them?
Yes. No.
Then shut up, Dave Weiss. People who can't even see your face on this show know that you are lying.
Yes, I saw those films. They're masterpieces.
I'm gonna say 80% knife.
All right. P.S. There's a thanks. Thanks, and please keep up the good work.
Oh.
P.S. Contrary to what Alonzo's grunts and moans insinuate, Dave's taste in music is totally rad. Uh-huh. I discovered this show after seeing a picture of Dave in a creator t-shirt and subsequently becoming intrigued by the prospect of reading a film critic who has a proclivity for death metal.
It's funny. There are people who love the Dave music, and then there are people who are like, I love the show when Dave isn't picking the music. And that's what we bring to the table.
Exactly. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin from Ottawa.
Next letter from Katie. Katie. Long-time listener. Just wanted to do as I was told and let you know about sound quality. It's been spotty in the past.
That's a kind way of putting it.
Dave used to be too soft, but he's been fine for the past couple months. This episode sounds great. Here's her favorite film.
Okay.
No particular order. The Sleeping Beauty, the Catherine Breillat Sleeping Beauty, which
did not see.
I'm a big Catherine Breillat fan. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen almost everything she's done, mm-hmm. but I have yet to see this one. Okay. I did not review it.
Okay.
And so I have not seen it yet, but I'm going to because I really love her films.
Sure.
Melancholia.
Just loved it.
Fantastic. The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, which I have not seen and everyone
see it
tells
either.
Me is so good.
I heard it's great.
Another Year.
Oh, great. Maybe not my favorite Mike Lee, but mm-hmm. great.
Winter's Bone. Which is a documentary about my family. A Serious Man.
Oh, loved it.
I really loved. And all the Pixar movies except Cars 2.
Yes, okay.
Keep up the good work. Katie, you're all knife to us.
Yes.
Yes.
A lot of very recent films on that list, but what the heck?
Yeah, whatever. Hanna-Barbera. Speaking of Lippy the Lion and Hardy Har Har. Oh, this is from Brian.
Oh, okay.
Of
Rupert Pupkin Speaks.
Rupert Pupkin Speaks. He has a 3-year-old daughter. Mm. He's been showing her lots of old Hanna-Barbera cartoons lately. Mm. You're a good father.
You know what he should show her?
What?
Panda Go Panda.
He probably already has shown her Panda Go Panda.
Probably.
He's such a movie nerd.
But just in case.
That he's probably already shown her Panda Go Panda. Panda Go Panda. Little kids love Panda Go Panda. If you've got little tiny kids, get them Panda Go Panda.
They will plots.
He started with Scooby-Doo. This has nothing to do with movies. He's talking about cartoons.
Okay.
Now. He's shown her Speed Buggy, Goober and the Ghost Chasers.
Oof.
And one he had never seen before called Frankenstein Jr. and the Impossibles. You remember that?
They had a car, right?
Yeah. Started researching Hanna-Barbera's output and was stunned at just how much they churned out over the years.
Oh, yeah.
Warner Archive has brought out a bunch I'd never heard of. For instance, have you ever heard of The Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan? Oh, yes, we have.
The Amazing Chan. Interesting trivia note about the Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan.
Yes.
It's the one time, I think, in popular culture that Charlie Chan was played by an Asian.
Seriously?
Seriously. In all the movies, white guy in yellow face.
Oh, man.
Key Luke, who played Number One Son in a lot of the movies, was the voice of Charlie Chan in The Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan. The first Asian to play Charlie Chan.
And the first Asian-American Saturday morning cartoon characters, right? Are we thinking, is that true also?
Probably.
Was it on before or after Kid Power was on? Remember that terrible show?
Yes. God. Based on the Wee Pals comic strip. I don't know, but probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly network, because I think the Kid Power was like syndicated.
We grew up in the 70s.
Oh, and how.
Yeah. All right, Brandon.
Yes.
Shaun of the Dead.
Okay.
Reefer Madness, the movie musical. I have not seen it.
Did not see it. It was made for Showtime with Christian Campbell.
Yeah, I heard it was no good.
I've heard it's okay. Well, you probably heard it was no good from a friend of ours who did his own Reefer Madness musical and got mad that somebody else has got more famous.
Oh, all right.
But who knows? I haven't seen it.
He's probably right, though. He's a big complainer, but he often complains about things that deserve complaint.
Not Brandon, our friend.
Yeah. A Dirty Shame.
Yes, okay.
Not my favorite John Waters movie,
right, but
fun.
But fun.
The Life Aquatic, again, not anyone's favorite.
Brandon's, apparently.
Not anyone's favorite
Wes Anderson movie,
but I like it. Yeah. Moonrise Kingdom, which is terrific. Scott Pilgrim, which is so great and little underseen.
Yeah.
Definition of cult film, really, now, is what it has become.
Definitely.
Once, which I often forget to remember how great Once was.
Yeah.
Because now that all the dummies like it, I
now that it's a Broadway musical. Yeah, it is a little tiny thing of beauty.
Fried Green Tomatoes. I was not a fan of that movie when I saw it in the theater so many years ago.
Here's the thing. I love the book.
I've never read the book.
The book is so great. Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fannie Flagg. And there is so much going on in that book. You could do a whole other movie of the stuff that isn't in the Fried Green Tomatoes movie.
Right.
Like the Cicely Tyson character. There's a whole other thing about like the black people in town and their stuff that doesn't even make it into this movie. I think the Fried Green Tomatoes movie is very like, it's very feel-goody and of course very famously sort of whitewashes the lesbian content.
That was my problem. I didn't even know anything about the book or anything about the film going in when I sat down and watched it that day in North Park 1 in Dallas. And as I watched it, I thought to myself, she's a lesbian. When are they going to tell us that she's a lesbian? And they never did.
Yeah, it's very cool.
The movie ends and they never tell you that she's a lesbian. You're left wondering why she's going so crazy over this other woman.
Yeah.
And you never understand why. Unless you're sitting there like me thinking, well, obviously you're a lesbian. When's the film going to acknowledge this?
Yeah, I think that was maybe like around the last time that a big movie would try and duck the elephant in the room that way. I think after that, I was like, okay, yes, fine.
And not even allowing the audience to know that this was a lesbian without even, like, if she wasn't going to be honest with herself about it.
That the narrative understands.
The narrative didn't even pretend to understand what was going on. I hate that.
Yeah.
All right. Kung Fu Hustle. Just fantastic.
I need to see it.
Such a great movie. Coraline.
Love it.
Lars and the Real Girl, which I really like.
Didn't see it.
It's really, really, really good.
Hey, Girl.
And
Hey, Real Girl.
And Kinky Boots. Oh. Yeah. That's a terrible movie.
I'm sorry, Brandon, but
we hate to inform you, Brandon, but Kinky Boots is terrible.
Yeah. Any movie where a drag queen gets heckled by the audience and goes off stage and cries? No.
Drag queens don't cry.
Drag queens heckle
they
back
multiply.
And draw blood. That's what that's what drag queens do. Kinky Boots.
All right, what do we got here?
He doesn't get Kinky Boots. He doesn't get Fried Green Tomatoes.
We're going to give you the benefit of the doubt in Reefer Madness because we haven't seen it.
Is that 80%?
You're 80%.
You're 80%.
You're 80%. Yeah. Oh, he says more than 10. More than 10.
Okay.
So. Okay, last one for June, and then we're done.
Oh, I thought that was a title.
At the end of this episode, we will have caught up to all the mail of June. This is from Duncan. I have never had any sound trouble with your podcast.
Yay.
Thank you. My top 10 movies are Queen's Logic.
I never saw that one.
Starring Kevin Bacon and Ken Olin of 30 something.
And like Joe Mantegna?
Yeah, it's got everybody of that time in it. It's an early 90s movie.
Never saw that one.
I saw it. I was bored.
Okay.
And I only have that memory of it.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you what it's about.
That was your takeaway?
Just my takeaway after bored. 20 years is, oh yes, that bored me. I don't remember what happens in that film. Dangerous Liaisons? I'm a fan.
I like a lot of it. I don't like Michelle Pfeiffer's performance in that
movie. Yeah. See, I like her the most.
Yeah.
L.A. Story.
Love it.
It's great. Clue.
Who doesn't love Clue?
Me, but you are a gigantic fan. I know. The Big Lebowski, Velvet Goldmine, 12 Monkeys, Labyrinth, The Fifth Element, and The Princess Bride.
I see a motif here.
Yes, you do see a motif. All right, we're going to give you everything except Queen's Logic because...
Dave was bored.
It's boring. It is a boring movie. Thank you, Duncan.
You are 90% knife.
Special bonus shout out to Joe versus the Volcano, which I adore but acknowledge is not very good. And I love that it's on the marquee in your profile picture on the podcast.
I know he can get the job, but can he do the job? All right, I'm not arguing that with you.
We're done.
I'm not arguing that with you.
Give us the outros.
Okay. As always, we thank you for listening. Drop us a line with your own top 10 list and any other questions or comments or whatever you might have at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at linoleumcast. Check into the show at getglue.com. Did you know that GetGlue apparently just hit like 3 million users or something? Or 30 million?
3 million gluesers.
30 million. It's like some big, like a lot of people are using that site.
That's what they should call people who use
gluesers.
Gluesers.
And they have a new iPad app, apparently. Anyway, you can check into the show at getglue.com. We're still listed as a TV show, but whatever. You can subscribe to us for free on iTunes. And if you like the show, hey, leave us a review. We would love that. It helps other people find the show.
A good one. Not a bad one. A good one.
Yes, that would be nice.
You got negative things to say, you keep that stuff to yourself. Not interested.
You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio and at thelounge.com. And as always, we point you to our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. The last few episodes of Popcorn Mafia, before Gray Drake packs it all in and goes full-time over to Rotten Tomatoes Radio Thursday afternoons on Sirius. Yep. I think Sirius 104. Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, who we really need to have on the show because they tape that show next door.
I know.
So we need to have a
Throwing
Shade crossover.
We do need to have them. We need to have them walk 20 feet
exactly
over to our apartment.
To the show, yes. Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash with That Chris Gore, The Game Night Guys, and, of course, our dear friends at Secretly Timid. We've done another one. You have wasted another 82 minutes of your life listening to us.
That was too long.
No one ever complains about the shows being too long, except you. Listeners always say, keep them coming.
All right.
We thank you for liking the long shows. We thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.